Thank you very much. So I'm going to tell you about what is called the electromagnetic response. It's a joint work I'm doing with Carlos Hoyos. It has not been published yet. We received crucial help from Nicret that I will mention during the talk. So Chris said that it is a great way to start the program. I'm not sure about that. So first, I start with the apologies. Apologies that this talk is not will not be directly related to ADS-CFT correspondence. And for those of you who are interested in whole viscosity from the point of view of ADS-CFT correspondence, I can refer you to a paper that Omid Saremi and I wrote some time ago. And the reason that I'm not going to use ADS-CFT here is that Galilean invariance is going to play an important role in what I'm going to tell you. And although Galilean symmetry can be realized in ADS-CFT, I think for the moment it is important to understand just the from the point of view of field theory how things work out. In the relativistic case, there is an inspiring paper by Eduardo Fradkin and collaborators. But what we will see here is that in the Galilean invariant case, some things are even simpler.
One complaint. I was the last author in the paper. The main credit goes to the paper.
Okay. Yeah. So we are new to the subject. Please feel free to criticize. I appreciate your comments. So first, let me tell you what is whole viscosity in a very intuitive way. Let us recall that a fluid is described by the equation of fluid dynamics. We have the continuity equation, d rho over dt is equal to the divergence of the current, and also the conservation of momentum, also called the Navier-Stokes equation. Here J can be thought of as the mass density, or at the same time it is the momentum density. Mass current is equal to momentum density in the non-relativistic Galilean invariant system. So J here is simply rho times the velocity. In fluid, usually the stress tensor comes is written in the form that contains the ideal fluid part and the viscous part. Okay, so eta here is proportional to the what is called the shear rate, which is telling you how much different part of the fluid moves with different velocities. So there is a friction force between different part of the fluid. So there is a viscous contribution to the stress tensor. This construction can be written purely from the symmetry considerations alone. You expand Tij in term of rho v and keep only term to first derivative, and you get in a general dimension you get only these terms. However, in two dimensions, it was noticed by Avron, Zeiler, and Zograf some years ago that it is possible to write down a term that is rotational, rotationally invariant, but breaks parity. So here, this term here can be constructed in two dimensions because of the existence of the epsilon ij tensor. Okay, so in two dimension, one can write down a contribution that has one derivative, that is the same number of derivatives as the usual viscosity, but breaks parity. And that term is called the whole viscosity term in the in the stress tensor. Okay, in picture, suppose I have a fluid and I try to move one part of the fluid with respect to the other part, setting off a gradient of the velocity, dUx over dy. Then according to the previous formula, the usual viscosity will be a stress that try to slow down the fluid. So the stress force will be acting on the direction that is parallel to the motion of the fluid, while the whole shear stress looks something like that. It acts on another direction, on the perpendicular direction. So that's why it's called the whole viscosity. It is similar to the whole conductivity. When you apply an electric field, you get a current that is perpendicular to the direction of the electric field. Okay. So the whole viscosity has been computed by Avron and others for the quantum Hall state. So let us turn our attention to the quantum Hall state and try to discuss the viscosity, the whole viscosity. What is the whole viscosity for the quantum Hall state? So the simplest example of a quantum Hall state is non-interacting electrons filling the lowest n Landau levels. You have a two-dimensional gas of electrons. For simplicity, that assume the electron to be non-interacting, turn on a magnetic field, and assume that the chemical potential lies between two Landau levels. Then you fill all n, an integer number of Landau levels. The system has a gap because of the quantization of the energy level of a single particle in a magnetic field. So there is no low energy degree of freedom. Okay, everything is gap. No low energy degrees of freedom. That means that the effective action of such a system can be written purely as a sum of polynomials of the external fields. It is a local function of external fields, and it is known that to lowest order, the action is just the Chern-Simon action written here, where A mu is the external gauge field. You can see here that it is a purely a local term. And if you differentiate this action with respect to the external field, you get the current. And the current will give you the whole conductivity. And you can compute from this formula the whole conductivity yield, and you will find sigma xy equal to mu over 2 pi times E square root h, that is put to 1 in this formula. So you can identify this mu with the filling fraction of the quantum Hall state. So for the simplest example here, the number mu here is simply equal to n. But there are more complicated quantum Hall states. The fractional quantum Hall state will have mu equal to 1/3, 1/5, etc. Okay, and other fractions. Okay, but I will claim that this is not the full story, and if one try to go beyond the leading order, there are interesting structures that would appear. But before doing that, let us discuss symmetry of the microscopic theory. Okay, so let us start by discussing the simplest example, non-interacting electrons in external gauge field. But to make the discussion general, I will also assume the electron to move not in flat space-time, but also in curved space. Okay. So here, if I look at this Lagrangian, I will see that there are electrons moving in a curved space. So there is a spatial metric. And in addition to the spatial metric, I also introduce coupling of psi this non-relativistic field to external gauge field. Okay. So this theory has two obvious invariances. One is the gauge invariance, where psi goes to a phase times psi, and we make the appropriate gauge transformation of the gauge field, and the action remains invariant. Okay, another invariance is the spatial general coordinate invariance. So since I have written, written Gij times Didj here, for example,
we can see that we can make the usual general coordinate transformation on psi, A naught, AI, and GIJ, so that the action remains invariant. In this transformation, psi and A naught transform as scalars, AI transforms like a vector, spatial vector, and GIJ transformed like a tensor. Okay. Now, in order for the action to be invariant, it is easy to see that this parameter psi here has to be time independent. If it was time dependent, then this time derivative term here will give you trouble. So the action that is written here has invariance with respect to time independent reparameterization of the coordinate system. Okay. However, we can show, and it was shown by Matt Wingate and myself some years ago, that this transformation can be generalized to be time dependent. So a non-relativistic theory of particles moving in a time dependent metric, external metric, in a time dependent external gauge field is invariant with respect to a more general set of transformations that we call non-relativistic diffeomorphism. And they are written here. So you see, these Li derivative terms here are simply the transformations of the fields with respect to time independent psi. If the psi parameter is time dependent, you get extra pieces in the transformation of the scalar potential and of the vector potential as well. And one can check that Galilean transformation is a special case of this. Yes.
Right. So you have a spatial metric which is time dependent.
I have a spatial metric that is.
But you're not putting in any laps. So, I mean, you have fixed slicing?
Have fixed slicing, yeah, in space.
So it's different from a space-time metric. I mean, you have fixed slices, but you have a metric on the slice chain.
Uh-huh, yeah. So time right now, it's, it can be generalized, but this will be sufficient for us. So basically, I have x goes to x plus psi, and psi has only spatial index. And t goes to t. T doesn't change. Okay, so the Galilean transformation can be thought of as a special case of the non-relativistic diffeomorphism invariant. So this transformation can be thought of as the gauge version of the Galilean transformation. Any questions? Okay, so.
Is it a special property of the free case, or is it obvious how to that this survives interactions?
Yeah, I will tell you how to introduce interaction later. So one can see how does this. One can get this transformation by doing a non-relativistic reduction of an action of a scalar, of a complex scalar. So let us assume we have a relativistic theory of a complex scalar field. This should be m squared here with the mass m. Let us now take the non-relativistic limit where, as usual, we single out the part of the, this should be phi. Phi is the relativistic field. It has a phase that varies quickly in time. With the frequency equal to the mass of this particle. This phase, we single out this fast rotation in phase, and then we insert that into the action. But now we assume that g mu nu has the form that is written here. the spatial metric will be the spatial part of G mu nu, while the gauge field will appear as the zero mu component of the relativistic metric. If we insert this ansatz into the relativistic action and then neglect all terms suppressed by power of c, the speed of light, then we will get the non-relativistic version of the non-relativistic action of a particle in external field and in external time-dependent metric. It's very similar to the Kaluza-Klein reduction, but here we are doing, what we are doing here is the non-relativistic reduction. The zero mu components of the metric becomes gauge field. Okay, and the relativistic diffeomorphism invariant will reduce into the non-relativistic transformation that I have written before. So in the relativistic theory, there is you can reparametrize x mu. X mu goes to x mu plus psi mu. For the case mu equals zero, if you do a transformation, the reparameterization of time, that transform into the gauge transformation of the field of this field psi, because of the, you change the phase here. While if you do mu equal I, the reparameterization of space, you will find the general coordinate transformation that I've written before. And it is now clear why the general coordinate transformation mixes the gauge field and the metric, because both the gauge field and the metric are descended from the full relativistic metric. Okay. So this is simply the non-relativistic limit of the relativistic diffeomorphism. Okay. And that will be useful for us in a moment.
Can this be interpreted geometrically? I mean, it looks like Kaluza-Klein time direction. Is there a geometric interpretation?
That's, yeah, I don't know. That seems that we restrict ourselves to fields that has a frequency close to a certain frequency in the time direction. So now, let me show you how to introduce interaction in a way that preserves this invariance. So when we introduce interaction in the system, there is an ambiguity how to couple the system to the external metric. We can use that ambiguity to enforce the condition that the general coordinate invariant is preserved. So we do that by writing down, so in non-relativistic Lagrangian, usually you introduce interaction by writing down a potential that is non-local in space. But we can also use introduce interaction by using mediating fields. For example, if one needs to introduce Coulomb interaction between particles moving in two dimension, what we can do is the following: first, we couple the density to a zero component of a gauge field A0. And then let A0 propagate in 3 plus 1 dimension. And we write down the action for the A0 field as written here. So in the case of a flat metric, you can see that this A0 simply mediates a 1 over R potential between two particles. There is no time derivative here, so it means that the interaction is instantaneous. It should be in non-relativistic physics. But one can also check that this action, as written here, preserves the previous non-relativistic invariance if we assume the A0 to transform like a scalar. Yes?
You're preserving non-relativistic stiffly-morphic invariance in 2 plus 1 matrices.
Yeah, in 2 plus 1, in 3 plus 1. So the metric should not depend on the z direction.
And the coupling with psi is through some value of z on the boundary?
On the boundary, yeah. But z equals 0. So it is a little bit complicated because we want to model the real electron system interacting through a Coulomb potential. If we just need some kind of interaction, I could write down here, for example, Yukawa interaction in two dimension, and that would work. But I want to say here is that almost all interactions can be introduced in such a way that the general coordinate invariance is preserved. Okay, so now the microscopic theory that we start with has an extended symmetry. We can ask the question, is the Chern-Simons action invariant with respect to this symmetry? The symmetry of a microscopic theory should be inherited by the effective theory. So it's easy to see that the Chern-Simons action is gauge invariant, and it is Galilean invariant, but it is not a diffeomorphism invariant. And direct computation tells us that the change of the Chern-Simons action is non-zero, and it is written here. Here E is the electric field, the external electric field. Psi is the parameter of the transformation. Yes.
Chern-Simons is invariant under the 2 plus 1 DPOs. It's just a freeform.
Yeah.
Independent
but
of a metric, right?
Yeah, but the reason here is that
it's not invariant under this special non-relativistic limit.
Yeah, because of this extra contribution. All the trouble comes from this term that mixes the gauge potential does not transform like a three vector, the three vector. If you write down the transformation laws that involve that is for three vector use, you will not have this term.
How did the M get there? Is that because you rescaled by the time dependence?
So the M, how does the M get there? So the M, how do I see it? Yeah, this, you can see it from this dimension of the reduction, the non-relativistic reduction has an M in here.
So I don't know, suppose you started there, you asked what is the electromagnetic response of the relativistic action.
Mm-hmm.
That would give you a Chern-Simons, well, I guess it won't, because it's a scalar, so you're not fermions.
Well, if you had a fermions, you would get some.
But
some,
that would be,
some action.
And that would be right. Okay.
The thing is that actually under power counting that I will mention later, this term has a smaller, it is more suppressed than the Chern-Simons action. Yeah. So it will be compensated. This has to be compensated by higher derivative terms in the effective action. The Chern-Simons term itself is not invariant. Its variation will be compensated by terms that are more suppressed.
No, what I meant is that if you do it, that is at the level of the relativistic theory.
Mm-hmm. You will have to get the whole series of terms, not just the Chern-Simons term, but
you get all that.
Yeah, all the other terms.
So right now we just start with a fermion and it has diffeomorphism in them. So then the non-relativistic limit, you get both the metric and the gauge field out of the original metric. And I guess the question is, if you started to begin with a fermion that couples to a relativistic fermion couples to a metric and some other gauge field, once you do reduction, you get a non-relativistic system with but the gauge field that came out of the metric and some gauge field that just was a gauge field to begin with. And the second one, the transimus term for the second gauge field should be, was relativistically invariant to begin with. But
in the non-relativistic, limit, if you do the non-relativistic reduction, the fermions will couple to the sum of the gauge field and the gauge field that comes from the metric. So only the sum of the two gauge field will enter the.
But only one of them seems to transform under generalized diffeomorphisms in the way you described the one that came out of the metric. The other one should.
But since you are you're at the non-relativistic level, you are sensitive only to the sum of the two, and you are interested only on the transformation properties of the sum of the two gauge field, and this is the gauge field that I call A mu. I could have introduced here instead of D mu phi star D mu instead of this D mu another gauge field, but at the end what will happen is that at the non-relativistic level, I will see this little a mu to be added to that to the big a mu.
The little a mu and the capital a mu transform the same.
No, little a mu transform without any extra terms. The capital a mu transform because capital a mu come from the relativistic
the sum
metric.
Should transform differently than what
the sum transform exactly as I wrote here. The sum will transform exactly like this. If you add the little a mu that transform homogeneously, then it doesn't. This term, for example, will remain there for the sum. Okay, so the Chern-Simons term clearly requires some higher order corrections, so that the higher order terms. The variation of the change of the higher order terms is minus of that, and the total action is invariant. We can see that this cannot be achieved by a local term. One can just try to write down all the local terms with appropriate number of derivative and see that it cannot be achieved.
Parity
is broken. Parity is, yeah.
Where is it broken?
Parity, you have an external magnetic field. You have an external magnetic field.
Reduction.
Sorry? So the...
By non-zero A sub I, you're saying?
By non-zero what?
A sub I.
By non-zero B, is curved A. So that is important comment because the higher order term turn out to contain inverse powers of B. The quantum Hall state with diffeomorphism invariant does not exist at zero magnetic field. So from the symmetry, what we find out that it is impossible to compensate for this term by adding to the Chern-Simons action local. A term local in external fields. From that we conclude that the quantum Hall state with diffeomorphism invariant, that means with the which at the microscopic level is Galilean invariant, it cannot exist at zero magnetic field. So for example, the terms that compensate for the variation of this Chern-Simons term will be M divided by B times E squared. Roughly speaking, look like this. Before writing down all terms that contribute to the next leading order, let us first discuss the power counting and what we call by order 1, what we call by order epsilon, what we call order epsilon squared, etc. Power counting in power of momentum. So power counting. So first of all, we said that in the non-relativistic system of non-interacting electrons, there is only one scale, the magnetic field. So the magnetic field gives rise to the magnetic length scale, that is, roughly speaking, the radius of the smallest Lamour orbit n, the Lamor frequency, be divided by m. So we are interested in the physics at length scale much bigger than the magnetic length, and happening at the time scale much larger than the inverse Lamor frequency. And for definiteness, I will choose the following convention, that the spatial derivative is assumed to be suppressed by power of epsilon compared to the microscopic scale, momentum scale, and the time derivative is suppressed by epsilon squared times the energy scale. That turned out to be a nice choice. In this choice, we can then assume our perturbation of the external field to be such that delta A I is proportional to 1 over epsilon. Delta A naught, the change of the A naught, the scalar potential, is B divided by M, and the change of the metric is of order 1. That is very non-trivial regime, because that means that our external fields are slowly varying, but nonlinear, very nonlinear. For example, if we compute the change of the magnetic field, the change of the fluctuation of the magnetic field that we are interested in is of the same order as the average magnetic field by itself. So D times delta A is proportional to B. The change of the scalar potential is of the same order as the chemical potential itself. So we have nonlinear variation of both magnetic field chemical potential and the metric. The only thing we need is that this variation happens at very large times and spatial scale. Any question? Okay, so this is the regime we want to write, for which we want to write down the effective Lagrangian. So the electric field will contain 1 power of epsilon. The magnetic field is of order 1. The variation of the magnetic field is of order 1. The electric field is of order epsilon, compared to the natural microscopic scale. Now, the whole viscosity is described by a Wen, something called the Wen-Z term. And it was first written down by, the first place I see that it discussed is in Nick Reed's 2009 KITP talks. Nick forgot about that, and he mentioned it to me in 2011. And so the construction of this term is very similar to the construction of the Chern-Simons term, but it involves the external metric in a non-trivial way. So let us now introduce, instead, reparameterize the metric in terms of a field bind, EAI, where A runs 1 and 2, I runs 1 and 2. Okay. Here's we assume summation over A. From that field bind, we can define a spin connection. Spin connection is defined in the standard way for the spatial component. The crucial thing here is that we have a O2 rotational invariant ambiguity, O2 ambiguity in the choice of the field bind. So we can rotate the field bind in a plane, and that translates into a U1 transformation of connection, of the spin connection. Okay. So the spin connection here contains both the spatial and the temporal the temporal components. Okay, so let us now also remind ourselves that the field line, the scalar curvature, can be understood as the flux of the gauge field defined by omega mu. Omega contains one derivative of the metric, and if you construct the field tensor for this omega I, we will see some construction that it has two derivatives of the metric, and it's simply the scalar curvature in two dimensions. Okay, so since omega mu under O2 rotation of the field line transformed like a gauge field, a U1 gauge field, we can write down, in addition to the Chern-Simons term, the following topological terms that are called the Wen-Z terms, because these are written first by Wen and Z in the 90s. So we can write down a mixed Chern-Simons term between omega mu and a mu. Omega mu is the spin connection, and we can write down the terms, the Chern-Simons term for omega mu alone. Any question? Okay, so by our power counting, this term is of order epsilon squared. So it is 2 order of epsilon suppressed compared to the Chern-Simons term. So this is the term that we want to keep. The omega d omega term is omega is epsilon to the fourth, and we will not go that far in our derivative expansion. So we will be interested in this term. By the Wen z term, from now on I will mean the omega d a term. So this first term here give rise to two physical effects. One is the so-called the shift, also first considered by Wen and Z, and the second effect is the whole viscosity.
So this term is another way to rewrite this 1/b term, is that right? Or
it is different? Separate, yeah. Separate. So the B term does not involve this term here does not involve the spin connection at all. Mm-hmm. Can be written down in term of the metric, while the Wen-Z term cannot be written down purely in a gauge invariant way through the metric.
Does the counting?
Okay. How about the counting? So suppose I have. Suppose I choose the following. Suppose I choose here to be 0, 1, 2. So D1A2 is the magnetic field. So it's count as order 1. Omega 0 contains one time derivative. And the time derivative count is epsilon squared. So it is epsilon squared.
If you're thinking the variations of magnetic field to go further one, the number of field Landau levels is going to change. So how can...
Suppose you fill only the first Landau level, case, and then you... Suppose you assume that there is a... that your chemical potential is lies between two Landau levels, then you change the magnetic field. Okay, so your picture looks like this. If the variation... you can make the variation not too strong, so that you don't excite particle in the next Landau level, but the variation can still be of order 1. Like 10% is fine. 20% is fine. So that parametrically you can have order 1 variation. The same for the chemical potential. If you have the chemical potential varies between two Landau levels, that should be
it's
fine.
It's important to do this in grand canonical ensemble. Then.
It's in grand canonical ensemble. Okay, so the Wen-Z shift is what will allow us to compute the coefficient in front of the Wen-Z term in the action. So we can rewrite the when C terms as WZ, where WZ is not West to Minor, but similar to West to Minor, like that. So we have epsilon mu nu lambda, A mu d nu omega lambda. But recall that if nu and lambda are special, then we have the flux, the magnetic field with respect to the spin connection field, that is simply the scalar curvature. So in the action, there is a term proportional to A naught times the scalar curvature. And if we now compute the total particle number from the effective action, what we find by differentiating the Chern-Simons term will be the magnetic flux. And from differentiating the when Z term is the curvature. Okay? So the total number of particles in our quantum Hall state is equal to the number of magnetic flux times the filling fraction plus this kappa times the Euler characteristics of the manifold. Okay. Suppose I'm on a torus. On a torus, I can solve the equation of a particle moving in a magnetic field, like in the textbook, and I will find that the number of particles in the lowest Landau level, for example, is equal to the number of magnetic flux. However, if I solve the problem on a sphere, there is a correction of order one. So this I can rewrite the number of particle is equal to nu time n phi number of flux plus a number s. This s is called the shift introduced by Wen in Z, and it is related to the number kappa by this the coefficient kappa in front of the action in this simple way. So using this formula, we can find kappa for the quantum Hall state that we are interested in. For example, for the integer quantum Hall state with nu equal n, with n Landau levels, this kappa equal to n squared over 2. And for the Laplin state, we can also put Laplin state on a sphere. Haldane wrote down the Laplin wave function on the sphere, and from that we can find this kappa to be 1/2. The coefficient here is completely determined by some topological properties of the quantum Hall state. Okay, now the whole if we now look at the Wen Z term as omega naught times d1, there is a term like omega naught times d1a2 minus d2a1. This one is b. And this omega naught, recall, is ede. If we now expand it around the flat metric, we will find that the Wen Z term contribute, receive a contribution proportional to h dh. And that give a contribution of order omega to the two-point functions of the stress tensor. And from that, we can find the whole viscosity. The whole viscosity can be related to the response. Basically, it is a response, a stress response of the system on external gravitational fields. And it is encoded in this quadratic term in the Wen Z action. So we find that the whole viscosity of the quantum Hall state is simply the product of the Wen Z shift and the total density of particle. This result has been derived by Nick Reed previously, and here we see that it appears in a natural way from the action principle. Okay, so now we can write out all diffeomorphism invariant terms up to order epsilon squared. So this term is of order epsilon to the zero power, and it has this contribution will make this thing diffeomorphism invariant. The Wenzi terms also need correction to make it diffeomorphism invariant up to order epsilon square, and the correction is written here. There is one term that simply has a very simple interpretation. It is the total energy of a particle of the system in external field. So the contribution to the action looks like a negative of the potential energy minus epsilon of B, and it also receives a contribution, which in the form of this term is the same as this term, although this term depends on the energy as a function of the magnetic field. And two other terms we are not very interested in. They are of order epsilon square, but for the effect that I'm going to talk about, they are not, they will not matter. So, but the bottom line is that we can write down and classify all the terms that are invariant with respect to diffeomorphism to order epsilon square.
L1 and L2 are apparently non-invariant, and L4 and L5 are apparently invariant. Is this why you don't care about them? They have no epsilons. Or what's
so,
the difference between L2 and L4 and L5?
So L4 and L5 simply don't have electric fields. So I will be talking about response of the theory when I turn on external electric field. Okay, there is something known called the Kohn's theorem. Kohn's theorem fixes the current correlator at zero momentum and not non-zero omega, and it is physically it is understood in the following way. If you turn on electric field that is homogeneous in space, all you are moving is the center of mass of the system. And our effective action actually captures the next leading order correction to conductivities at Q equals zero. If we compute from this action here, namely there is one term, namely this term, that contribute to the sigma xx and sigma xy at zero Q, but non-zero omega, and the correction is consistent with Kohn's theorem. It is simply the first term in the Taylor expansion of sigma xy with respect to, we will see the first correction proportional to omega in sigma xx. So the Kohn's theorem is satisfied. Kohn's theorem is simply the consequence of Galilean invariance, and the diffeomorphism invariance that we are talking about here is generalization of Galilean invariance. So there is no surprise that we satisfy Kohn's theorem. Now, there's one more thing we can compute, that is the sigma xy, the whole conductivity as a function of the wave number. So let us imagine the following physical situation. Assume we have a two-dimensional system, magnetic field pointing this way. We turn on electric field along the x direction, that is spatially dependent, is dependent on x. So E here points to this direction, and E here goes to this direction. And the wavelength is assumed to be much bigger than the magnetic length. Then the flow of the electron will look like this, and we can measure the current in the y direction. The current in the y direction will determine what I will be calling sigma xy as a function of q. When q is equal to zero, the sigma xy has to be equal to the whole, to the quantized whole conductivity. But now from the effective action, we can compute the first correction, q squared correction, to the whole conductivity. And the q squared correction here comes from two terms in the effective action. Come from this term and this term. They have the same form. One is the Galilean invariant. One term makes the Wenzi term Galilean invariant, well, diffeomorphism invariant. The other term makes the energy term in the action diffeomorphism invariant. And so So we found this C2 having two contributions. One of the contributions is simply the when Z shift divided by 4. And this contribution has also been found by Nikrit and collaborators. But there is a second term. Now let me tell you how to understand these two terms in a physical way. The first term, first contribution to this correction C2, let's recall that this C2 is the coefficient in the Q squared correction to the whole conductivity at finite Q. Okay. Now we have this picture of fluid making a motion along the y direction, but the velocity depends on the x direction. Okay, so that means that there is a shear rate, vx vy plus dy vx. Dy vx here simply is equal 0. So this rate is not equal 0. Now, since the whole fluid has the non-zero whole viscosity, that means that there is a Txx that is non-zero. If the usual viscosity would tell us that there is a Txy that is non-zero, but the whole viscosity implies that there is a Xx component of the stress tensor that is non-zero. That means that on each volume of the fluid, there is an additional force proportional to the time the spatial derivative of Txx acting on it. And if we have a force acting along the x direction on elements of the fluid, that means that this element will try to move with along the y direction. So there is an additional contribution to the velocity of the fluid moving along the y direction. And that if we put in all the numbers, we find exactly the first term in the correction to the whole viscosity at finite Q.
Excuse me, I realize I'm confused about something.
Yeah.
You said the whole viscosity is proportional to the Euler number. That's this Wien Z shift, right?
The whole viscosity is proportional to the Wien Z shift. The Wien Z shift is proportional to the ratio. So the Wien Z shift here is the additional particle number due to the Euler number.
So it's a prefactor.
Yeah, it's a prefactor. Yeah.
Well, my question was that, I mean, the whole viscosity I thought was a local thing. You can look at, you know, some small piece of your sample and see what the viscosity is.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But from Q,
Q is a global thing. Yeah.
But you're saying that the actual viscosity is just the coefficient of that term. It doesn't depend on whether. So you don't need to have the global topology of your sample.
I don't need to. In order to find that that kappa, I need to know how many particles live in anything that has Euler number different from a torus. Torus will not give me any information about kappa. But if I put a system on a sphere, then I can find kappa. Okay, so the problem is simply solving quantum mechanics of a particle moving on a sphere with the magnetic field pointing from the center. So there is a magnetic monopole. You solve can ask the student to find the degeneracy of the Landau levels on a sphere. They will find it to be equal. First of all, the degeneracy is not equal to the magnetic flux, but it is equal to the magnetic flux plus 1 for the lowest Landau level magnetic flux, number of magnetic flux plus 3 for the second Landau level, etc.
By the way, do you know the kappa for fractional whole space?
Yeah, the fractional quantum Hall state, you write down the Laplacian wave function on a sphere. It's like all the has written down. So the for I know it for Laplacian state. In principle, one knows that for other fraction. I don't know it myself well enough to. Yeah, there is a complicated set of.
At least for the billion states, there was a classification by N and Z, and they listed all of them.
Yeah. They found.
For the simplest example.
Yeah. For the simplest example.
Let me come in. If you work, I mean, more intuitively, suppose you're still working, so you work on a plane. Mm-hmm. But imagine that the physical system has an edge dislocation or something like that. You represent the dislocation essentially as a local curvature. The way the electrons are moving on that surface coupled to the dislocation as if it were a singular contribution to the metric in which they would look like curvature. And so that essentially gives you, that's why these edge dislocations near the end point essentially is related to the Dirac vector of the edge dislocation, the sort of in the lattice construction.
I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with using effective theory for scale that is more. So I need the scale.
There's a topological piece.
There's a topological piece.
Associated with the Dirac, essentially, which is measured by the Dirac vector of the edge dislocation. So when you write down the electronic states, they pick up an extra phase. It's a phase part.
So the curvature is a compact.
Well, it is, well, it's like this problem here, there are scales in the problem. So it's not universal, yeah.
Well, here...
It's present,
I'm not sure.
There's a magnetic length. In the other case, there's some ultraviolet, some short-distance cutoff, which is another space.
Well, in this case, I think what is important is that the whole viscosity is completely... The formula for the whole viscosity is completely universal, independent of short distance physics.
Well,
at all.
Up to a
there
scale,
is only n.
Up to a scale, well, sure.
There is only n.
Right,
but the ratio of eta and n is,
right,
is a fixed.
N is the area of density, and that has units.
It's
not
unit,
a field factor.
But it is just the magnetic field.
I know. So here there is natural scale.
It is scale. The whole conductivity doesn't have any scale.
Okay, so
the whole viscosity is dimension full.
So this is because it's a Galilean invariant system, but if you take some of these topological insulators, which is what we were interested in our paper, there is an analog of this effect.
But there you will
and
have
you actually it's a lattice spacing that enters.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And
so
there's no analog of magnetic law.
So that's what I mean when I say in the Galilean invariant case, something are more, I think, as simple, is simpler.
Because there is a natural scale.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is no renormalization by interaction.
Right. No,
what is,
no. But the point is, aside from that, there is a universal aspect of that.
Uh-huh.
It's only the topological piece of the dislocation, if you wish, the fact that the dislocation is characterized by a topological charge. That gives you the contribution to the whole viscosity in that case. There is a prefactor that depends on microscopic physics. But
yes.
The fact that it's non-zero is because the dislocation is the topological object.
But in all this discussion, I don't need to think about any dislocation at all. Well, I can assume the curvature to be smooth.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you imagine some uniform distribution of dislocation, the only way you can do that is by bending the surface. So instead of having, you know, a chicken wire, you get a soccer ball. Right? You need to depend on it to have courage.
Right now, the metric for me is simply a mathematical device. At the end, the metric will be, I put the metric to flat. But the metric, I use the metric for intermediate state, so that I can write down I can restrict the term in the action.
So you want to do that essentially as a response to local shear?
Yeah, local shear induced by the electric field.
Can you incorporate boundaries in this?
Yes.
That I haven't thought about. It might be interesting, yeah, from the boundary.
So I don't need a magnetic monopole.
on a scale.
10 million singular pieces of metric.
Okay, so the first contribution simply comes from the fact that the motion of the fluid here has a non-zero shear. The second contribution is more subtle, and that's because of the following. So if I look at the motion of the fluid moves in such a way that at a given point there is a local angular velocity. So the angular velocity is half of dx dy minus dy dx. Dy dx is equal zero, so there is a local angular velocity. If I have a non-relativistic system in a rotating frame, it is equivalent to having the same system in a magnetic field. The Coriolis force can be identified with the Lorentz force. So instead of this rotation, I can think about the system as having an additional magnetic field equal to omega. Now, the whole fluid is diamagnetic because the energy of the fluid is equal to some function of the magnetic field. When differentiating the energy with respect to the magnetic field, we will find the magnetization. Now, the magnetization usually is uniform in space, but because of the additional magnetic field here, the magnetization becomes spatially dependent. And if we have a spatially dependent magnetization, there is an extra contribution to the current that is known to happen. In picture, we can think it in the following way. Magnetization is due to the currents that go in circle. So if we have magnetization that is spatially varying, that means that the different arrows here will have different strength. So for example, if magnetization here is less than magnetization here, then the current moving around this loop will be less than the current, will be more than the current moving around this loop, and then you have a current that moves in this direction. So there is a current proportional to the gradient of the magnetic field, of the magnetization. And combining all these effects, one can derive exactly this extra term in the coefficient C2. Okay? So there is an exact relationship between the correction to the whole viscosity at finite Q and the Wannsee shift and the energy as a function of B. The simplest limit is the limit of high magnetic fields. One of the limits that in condensed matter physics sometimes called the limit when there is no interlayer mixing. And this limit, epsilon of B, is the energy of free fermions. For integer quantum Hall state, if neglecting the interaction, for integer quantum Hall state, the energy is simply the energy of electron in n Landau levels. For fractional quantum Hall state with nu less than 1, the total energy is simply the energy of single electrons on the lowest Landau level times the density of the electrons. The Wannsee shift is also known, and so the first correction to sigma xy as a function of q into power of q can be computed exactly. So for integer quantum Hall state, the correction turned out to be negative of 3/4 of n times q l squared. Now, this correction can also be computed directly because this is a non-interacting theory, so we can, for example, compute the diagrams and the coefficient. People has computed that, and the coefficient turned out to be exactly equal to what we found here from the effective action and its symmetry. For the fractional quantum Hall state, in the high magnetic field limit, we know the energy density, and we know the Wannsee shift, so we know the correction that has to be of this form, when nu is equal to 1 over 2n plus 1. This formula is exact, and I don't know any other way to derive it. So it would be it is a prediction of the of this approach. Okay. So let me conclude by giving some comments on the whole viscosity. the standard definition of the whole viscosity is stress induced by shear. So we have to, for example, turn on external perturbation of the metric in the form of the lattice vibration, for example, in order to find the whole viscosity. However, a few years ago, Haldane proposed that the whole viscosity for Galilean invariant system can also be understood as stress induced by spatially varying electric field. Basically, the electric field will induce the motion of the fluid and give you this shear. So here we found that the whole viscosity can be related to a purely electromagnetic quantity, that is the whole conductivity at small finite Q. And an interesting question is whether this sigma xy at finite Q can be measured. If it can be measured, one can check the validity of the formulas that we derive here. So in addition, we can the approach that we use here for the quantum Hall state, namely combining topology with non-relativistic diffeomorphism invariant, seems to be promising in, for other systems. For example, we can try to understand topological superconductors, for example, and try to see whether there is any consequences of the non-relativistic Galilean diffeomorphism invariant. And we are trying to understand that right now. Thank you.
So it's a pity that Tony isn't here, but how did Wen and Z arrive at this? They weren't. Was it also considerations of Galilean invariants?
No, they. They did not consider Galilean invariants. They were thinking about simply the gauge invariants, the U1, the 2U1 symmetry, one U1 from the field binding and another U1 of the experiment for the conserved particle number. So there is no.
So they were thinking about the free morphism.
They were interested in classification of. They were not interested in the diffeomorphism invariants at all. They were interested in classification of quantum state. So in addition to the ADA term, they say that the quantum state should be also additionally characterized by the omega ADA term.
Can
double-jump silence is a shift to zero with the pretty strong voice in here. So that I can double jump silence so that I put a diversal main copy also. Like in a much better way. So I take two, I make it diversal invariant by the opposite magnetic field, two layers. So then the shift vanishes.
So all that I'm talking about here is a system where the particle has the same charge mass ratio. So in this case, the only in this case would I say here.
Then you need to consider
the double jump
silence there,
which is. Those are both
but the Wednesday shift might be still this term in this case. You don't need Galilean invariants for you can just say what quantum terms are gauge invariants.
Cool.
So I don't know the answer.
Can you go back to your formula?
Which formula?
For sigma x bar. This one. I think it may be possible to derive that it's not an exact calculation, it's a more variational calculation of the spectrum of excitations of the Laplace states by Batsman and Darwin and McDonald. Mm-hmm. You see of the primary argument for constructing my initial states. And I think the calculator can solve part of these areas. I'm not, I may be wrong, but it's possible that. So they used what
is the
No, this was before composite fermions. Just they used the Laffer wave function and the assume what is called the single mode approximation. It's a density wave in the magnetic and the external magnetic field. Mm-hmm. And so there are these, so you have these mixing effects. It's all done in, you know, on the plane, so there's no curvature or anything like that. But I think they have expressions for the wave vector dependence of sigma x y. I may be wrong, but maybe worth checking.
Yeah.
The paper from the must be 84 or something. It's a very old paper.
Mm-hmm. I tried to look at the composite fermion calculation in the sigma x y. So after that, I think the problem is that the approximation can be. Can be made consistent with some of these invariants, but you need the epsilon, the total energy as a function of magnetic field, but in the composite fermion is...
That's why this other case may be simpler, because it doesn't require any of these other approximations. So you have the Laffer wave function, which is a variation of calculation on top of that of the first collective model. So the calculator, for instance, the calculator is magnetorotor. There is a minimum, so there's a corn mode, mm-hmm. and some finite wave vector comes down.
But it is not sigma xy function of q. It is a core in the
response. I know, but I think, it's buried in the calculation that the main information of it. Maybe wrong.
At the end of the day, if you do this calculation for quantum Hall states, And am I correct that these are quantum Hall states on flat,
flat space.
Yeah. You get physics for flat R2 out of this whole calculation involving different morphism invariants and stuff. Yeah. And it surprises me because, of course, a lot of work has been done on 2 plus 1 gravity, and the C1 connection has come up, all the time. But I would have thought on a flat plane, sure, you can introduce a dyad and you get a U1 gauge field. But it doesn't look like there's much physics there. So can you say any words to help me understand how out of this seemingly trivial gauge invariance that you write your three-dimensional metric in terms of a dyad, that you seem to get sort of interesting physics out?
So somehow the mere fact that it is possible to immerse the quantum Hall state in curve space-time somehow tells us that flat space physics is constrained. It's not all term possible in the action consistent with the symmetry of the flat space possible when you require that the system can couple to ground. I don't know how to explain that.
I was wondering if you could say something very brief about the paper with Ahmed Sarimi holography.
Yeah, we tried to construct we constructed the holographic model of a 2 plus 1 dimensional finite temperature fluid that has whole viscosity. We do that by introducing a scalar coupled to average R. So at the end, the theory there differed from what I'm talking here in two crucial aspects. First of all, it is relativistic. And secondly, it is a finite temperature, while the system that I'm talking about here is zero temperature and has a gap. So I don't know how to connect these two calculations right now. Probably we need to, in order to construct the ESCFT dual of
Galilean invariant whole fluid, one has to first start from some metric that has Galilean invariant and show the Galilean invariant. Try to start from there, but I don't know how to do that.
Any other questions? If not, let's think of something.